Right.
I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Tuesday, March 26, 2024. Time is 10:18. We're joined today by Representative Armstrong, Representative Stanley Wright, Representative Tom McKay, Representative Mike Prox, Representative Thomas Baker, and I am Chair, Representative Rauscher. So I'd like to thank Recording Secretary Kale Brown and our LIO moderators, Zach Lawhorn, my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all they do for our committee. We also are joined by Representative Shragi. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everybody to silence your cell phones, those electronics that you may have. All notes go through my committee aide, Craig Valdez, and any questions go through the chair and answers likewise on the reverse. Today's agenda is to hear testimony and presentation regarding the Rail Belt Transmission Grid from Gwen Haldeman, Senior Researcher and UAF Associate Vice Chancellor for Research, Innovation, and Industry Partnerships. For the record, we do not have before us today the bills that address this issue as they are currently in the other body. But the Energy Committee, I feel it is important to stay aware of the current situation and what will be coming our way. This follows from one of our first committee hearings last year when we heard about modernizing the rail belt from Brian Hickey, mentioned in that report from the Rail Belt Regional Coordinator, is a unified version of transmission infrastructure, the governance from the Rail Belt Utilities and AEA. These reasons are why I have asked Ms. Haldeman to come here today and present, not specifically focused on one particular bill, but the entire picture of the transmission line. So during the presentation and testimony, I encourage committee members to ask questions at the end of each slide if they do so. Vice Chancellor Haldeman, thank you for being with us today. Would you like to come forward? Please sit down. Give us your name, your affiliation for record, and then you can begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chairman Shragi. I mean...
Okay, brief and easy.
Chairman Rauscher. My name is Gwen Haldeman. I am the Associate Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I am based in Fairbanks, Alaska. I really appreciate the opportunity to come here and present before the committee today. This is an issue that we have been working on quite a lot through the university, trying to make sure that that we're able to provide information to stakeholders in the state about best practices for our future of our grid based on what's happening other places. Should I try? Is this are you guys getting an echo? Or is it just me?
I think we can hear you.
Okay. Should I try this one? Again. I think that one might be better. So I just want to start, you know, we don't think about our transmission system very much. We don't really think about the systems that bring us electric power until we start to have challenges with those systems. And we've started to see some of those. Energy is certainly a big issue. Energy supply and security for the rail belt grid is something that's becoming more apparent to consumers, both with supply of natural gas issues or concerns that we have. And then also just the recognition that we do have a vulnerable grid that does have certain single points of failure. We've seen that a few times that has impacted Anchorage specifically. For example, when we had wildfire back in 2019 that prevented us from getting Bradley Lake hydropower off of the Kenai Peninsula. And even more recently, as we've seen, you know, when we have generation sources that are knocked offline due to, you know, variety of potential issues, and we saw that with some cold weather snap in Anchorage, it can result in interruptions to service. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we do have a vulnerable electric transmission system. Everyone benefits from being part of an interconnected transmission system. It does enable us to have a more reliable system, and we're also able to ideally transact more power so that we're getting the lowest cost energy to consumers wherever they are from wherever it is being produced. These are kind of a couple of comments that I'd like to offer as our vision for the rail belt in the future. We are this interconnected system, but that system is still broken apart in terms of who owns it, who manages and who operates these individual components of our transmission grid. And I do really want to distinguish between transmission from distribution systems, that's how you're actually getting power to your house, versus sort of the high voltage electric superhighway that we want to have that's moving electrons around the state. And also separate it from the idea of generation, which is what we're using to produce power that we're putting on that superhighway. I think our goal for most of us for the rail belt grid is to get the cheapest cost power to end users wherever that power is produced, however it's produced, whatever that source is, and wherever that generation is located in comparison to where the end user is located. That's one goal that I at least would like to see as an Alaskan and somebody that uses that grid or gets my power from there. And then secondly, this idea of facilitating, and this says clean energy, but it's really not about clean energy. The grid doesn't distinguish between the source of power, whether it's coal, whether it's nuclear, whether it's wind, whether it's solar. Those electrons all look the same once it's on the electric highway. So it's really about facilitating any kinds of projects that can be built at scale to benefit our consumers. I just want to mention this idea of looking at our transmission system as a more integrated system is not a new idea at all. There's a report that is just about to be published called Electrifying Alaska's Rail Belt, a G&T History. It's written by Professor Phil White, who's an assistant professor in history and northern studies at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And in looking at this report, one thing that really struck me is that there have been more efforts to try to form sort of a consolidated transmission organization of some sort than there are actually organizations that serve the rail belt utility today. I thought that this particular committee would be interested in one of the first efforts called the Central Alaska Power Association, which was proposed by Chugach, Matanuska Electric Association, and Homer Electric Association back in the early 50s. And the idea there was to build new generation at scale on the Kenai Peninsula to power an aluminum smelter. That was proposed by the Harvey Aluminum Company, and they were planning to locate here in Alaska, and so they were looking for cheap power. And so the idea was to form a power pool, build out hydro at scale at rates that would represent dump power rates. And that's an actual quote from minutes of that time. And so the idea of dump power rates presumably means it's so cheap that you can just dump that power. And so that was actually a plan to build hydro out at scale and bring in a large industrial customer like an aluminum smelter. Sounds an awful like actually what Iceland wound up doing subsequently, but it was proposed here as well. Since then, you know, we in 1969 to 1970, Golden Valley, Matanuska Electric Association, Homer Electric Association, and Copper Valley Electric Association, which is not interconnected to the grid, proposed the Trans-Alaska Electric Cooperative. And their idea was to electrify pump stations up and down the Trans-Alaska pipeline and build out a transmission network between Palmer and Glen Allen. So we would kind of create this road belt transmission system. Eventually, that fell apart. ARCTEC, the Alaska Rail Belt Cooperative Transmission Electric Company, it was another effort that was made between Chugach, the city of Seward, and Golden Valley are the remaining entities that are still proponents of that. So, you know, there's a lot of these different options. Here's another example. This is from 2019 here on the slide. This is an effort to build out a for-profit transmission organization that would manage the transmission assets on the grid. The other map on the left here is actually the original map showing the larger version of the Susitna Hydroelectric Project with transmission lines benefiting consumers throughout the region going both north and south. So this is really the first map of the rail belt transmission grid from 1952. So we've been talking about this for a long time. As I said again, there's real advantages to being part of an interconnected transmission system. And so the question is just, how do we actually move from the benefits that being part of that system actually represent to really, to the extent we possibly can, seeing those benefits realized by consumers that are connected to that system. So one of the challenges that we have is that the utilities that exist on the rail belt, were structured as individual local utilities, right? So they were interconnected over time through this rail belt backbone grid, but they very much are subject to local politics, right? They're elected by local customers that elect a local board that have a mandate to prioritize local issues and local concerns. And there isn't really necessarily always that impetus to work collaboratively for the benefit of the whole. And so I kind of rate this as like a bit of a prisoner's dilemma, right? Where the individual choices that you make are not necessarily representative of the best choices for the whole, which ultimately then you yourself lose out on because you're not optimizing the opportunity that's presented. And that's kind of where we are today. We're in a little bit of a prisoner's dilemma where you've got these different options for how we might develop, structure, and use our transmission system, but we're not using it optimally because what might be of local interest in one place then kind of subsumes the greater good. And this is particularly important right now because we have an opportunity for making generational investments in upgrading these transmission systems. There's been recently announced that the GRIP funding through the Department of Energy, Alaska, it has the fifth highest amount of funding that's been awarded to any individual state or project or region. And that's partially recognizing the fact that Alaska has such a vulnerable and weak transmission system that really could benefit from significant upgrades.
So we do have a question from Representative Prox, but I do have one before we go there. You said that we aren't using it optimally. Are we using it as optimally as we can at this point? Because I think we are to an extent, but maybe I'm wrong. The transmission line that we have now, we're not using it optimally, you said. So I'm trying to understand, aren't we using it as optimally as we can, which is why we need to upgrade? Or am I wrong here?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Rauscher. Just to address that particular question, I think it's actually an excellent question. In many ways, the utilities have actually been working very much to kind of optimize the use of this transmission system. There's been an effort to put together a power pool, for example, in South Central, things like that. Optimal use of the transmission system is really about using it to move cheapest power from one place to another. Okay. And so in large part, we are succeeding on that today. Based on the distribution of resources that we have on this grid. For example, Golden Valley benefits from cheaper power moving north along the Alaska, along the transmission highway that moves north from South Central up to Golden Valley, which includes assets owned by both the state and by Golden Valley Electric Association. We all benefit from Bradley Lake hydropower being moved across the system. There are places where there's bottlenecks. That's a good example of one where we would benefit from having additional physical assets added to the system. And there's also, I think, opportunities for better where projects have been stymied or where we haven't moved forward with individual projects because of challenges in the way rates are recovered on how the transmission system is used. And so are we optimizing the use of it? I think the utilities are doing as well as they can under the current system.
Interesting. Representative Prox, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, through Chair, Ms. Holdman. You mentioned politically driven decisions, and part of the problem is that we're chasing subsidies and we're covering up the cost, the near-term cost at any rate. And I think that has happened in many instances and is still happening. Is there proposed some organization that is going to run this whole system in a more business-like manner? That is, that we put numbers and we talk about all of the possibilities that are available today and do the arithmetic and come up with, in the short term it's this, in the longer term it's that, kind of answers. A normal privately owned utility would do that. And then, yeah, the cost of power is apparently higher, but in the long run, maybe not. But is someone doing, is there some entity that would be responsible for looking at the whole system as an integrated business?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Prox, through the chair. You make a really good point here, and I think that this is actually the direction that that people would like to see the transmission system move. The idea here is that it would be more of an open highway, with the concept that there would be much more opportunity for private participation in the system. So again, the idea would be that if you can generate power from a coal project, from a nuclear project, from a wind project, or from a solar project that's cost competitive with options that currently exist on the grid, then you should have access to that system. It should be open access and available to everyone to use. And importantly, I want to emphasize local control over that, right? Because one of the other challenges that we have right now, like let's say that you're interested in purchasing power. You're a utility down in South Central, and you're interested in purchasing power from a project that makes technical sense that's in another service territory, right? Whether that's a coal project, whether that's a wind project. You have the opportunity, that utility doesn't even need to participate in a project, but that has that service territory. Mm-hmm. So you can execute, you can transact power agreements up and down the grid, making sure that projects are built where the resources are and at scale so we can get cheaper power. And in a lot of ways, the expectation is that in the future, utilities are not going to be the ones that are building these projects. They're going to be built by private independent power producers that are basically putting power into a competitive market.
Mm-hmm. If I may follow up.
Representative, go ahead.
Where I was going with that is that, yes, that can be done technically and theoretically. It is possible. But unless you do the arithmetic and have, you can say something, well, the Susitna Dam is a case in point. That probably would be the least expensive power source in the long run, but that doesn't come to play maybe 20, 30, 40 years from now. And someone has to put the arithmetic in there to really say this is why we think that either a whole bunch of renewable sources is the way to go because of economic considerations, or Susitna is the way to go because of economic considerations. And we have a projected break-even point and all those kind of things. Is somebody, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, I believe, did that to a degree for the clean energy standard, I think we call that. But they didn't get, well, they got close, but not close enough. But it's not helping us make a decision. Still politically chasing subsidies.
Representative Prox, through the chair, what you're really talking about is a planning process. Right. So really this idea of having some sort of an integrated planning process. And that's something that in the past, AEA conducted the last rail belt wide integrated resource plan. There is the responsibility for that right now sits with the Electric Reliability Organization for the rail belt grid, which is the RRC. Uh-huh. And so that's really what you're looking at there. The study that ASEP did was really taking a look at whether these different options that have been proposed for energy projects create challenges around reliability of delivery of energy, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we often hear about you can't run the grid off of wind and solar, right? So to what extent can you run the grid off of renewables? How much do you still rely on baseload power? And how do we ensure that we have reliable delivery of power services? And that was the question that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power was interested in exploring.
Mm-hmm. And that was certainly moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Yeah. Seeing no more questions, please continue.
So I already mentioned that right now there is this federal funding that's on the table for GRIP. This is a opportunity that we have in the state for some federal funding to update our transmission system. And these are upgrades that are really needed, regardless of how they're funded. Right now, because we have that opportunity, we also have an opportunity for the rail belt utilities to sort of come together to find a path for really coming up with some of these more institutional fixes to the structure that we have. And so there is a little bit of an opportunity space right now. We've seen this happen historically with the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, which is a state-owned asset, but one that the various utilities have all benefited from. And today represents one of the lowest sources of cost sources of generation on the grid today. When we look at our electric transmission grid, there's really three different kinds of constraints. There's these technical constraints that I mentioned that we're hoping that we can alleviate to some extent with these near-term opportunities for funding through GRIP. That includes two projects along with additional future options as we kind of look further north, including things like energy storage in addition to build-out of transmission assets. There's these economic constraints. These are things that right now would be fantastic to try to alleviate some of those. That includes things, as you mentioned, Chair Rauscher, are we using our electric grid as efficiently as possible? Part of that's really about economic dispatch of resources. So you want to use your least expensive source of generation first or next. As long as you don't have a constrained superhighway, that's preventing you from getting access to those cheaper resources. And there are constraints on the system and bottlenecks today. The other issue is really about wheeling, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but that's really about accruing costs for moving power through different service territories, different owners of these assets, charge money as a toll for moving power through their system. And this actually becomes a challenge in terms of developing new projects at scale that could benefit consumers because it distorts the economics of those projects. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then the last one is these sort of institutional constraints. As I mentioned, right now, a lot of these systems are owned at the local level or managed at the local level. There is some benefit for having somebody that's looking across the system as a whole for the benefit of the whole rather than local elements. So these are just kind of summarizing some of those points. So our rail belt politics are inherently local. I'm just asking the rail belt utilities to get together and solve this problem is difficult. It really asks them to do because they're responding to local boards, local pressures, and that sometimes doesn't necessarily mean that the benefit of the whole is being taken into consideration. Our energy sources are becoming more diverse, so they're going to be located in different places than they have been historically, right? The chance is good that there's going to be more economic energy projects, for example, developed on the northern side of the grid that we want to move south. And so this movement of bulk power back and forth and where those best resources are located is going to change over time. We do need to upgrade the system. We've avoided a lot of, our grid is really in the dark ages in a lot of ways, and part of it's because we've not been subject to some of the regulation and deregulation, really, that other grids have been subject to, other markets have been subject to. What's really been found to be best practices economically is to bifurcate the transmission system, which makes sense to operate as a monopoly, right? We don't want to have competing transmission grids moving power around a system, just like you don't want to have multiple state highway systems, because there's just too much cost associated with those, and they also take up physical space, right? So it's better to have that operating as a monopoly. Historically, the entire utility industry has operated as a monopoly. But we're seeing that nowadays there's a lot more room for competition, especially in the area of generation. And so that's really where most markets have really worked to open up and enable that free market competition. Whatever the cheapest energy sources are should be getting to consumers. And a lot of times that's not necessarily being produced by our utility industry anymore. It's often being produced by private developers through independent power production contracts or power purchase agreements.
So, yes. If I could, you basically briefly touched on the utility companies getting together, trying to work things to make some of this happen. Now, SB 123 came along after 6 years of work. Did it not work? Did it work? This is an outside looking in. Did it not work? Is it yet to work? I want to know how that played into where we are right now.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Rauscher, Chair Rauscher. The Rail Belt Reliability Council was the electric reliability organization that was selected for the Rail Belt grid. And that organization is responsible for three pretty big, important things. One of them is really set the reliability standards for the Rail Belt as a whole. That's a really important function that most energy markets have. And this is the organization that's been established to serve in that role. They're also intended to coordinate joint planning through an integrated planning process. So they are directed to lead that process. And then thirdly, they're also ensuring consistent interconnection protocols for the utilities, independent power producers, and others that would like to use the grid. And so they're doing these three things. This is in no way managing, owning, maintaining, operating the grid as a whole. They have a really specific and somewhat pretty important but limited function that they're intended to play. And they are working very hard to organize themselves to be able to meet those goals and that mandate that they have. And so to some extent, I would say there's an element of that they need some more time to get properly organized to be able to achieve those goals that were laid out by the legislature.
But as far as economic dispatch?
So,
is where we were talking when you mentioned that.
Yeah. So in the context of economic dispatch, that is something that if you are able to do things like, for example, there are limited avenues right now where economic dispatch is in the best interest of the utility. So this should be something that in an ideal world, you would like to see happen. It's also been required by the RCA, at least for South Central Alaska. There's been a requirement for a power pool that that certainly mandates economic dispatch between those utilities. In terms of where the is the question about how the ERO is responsible or involved with economic dispatch? One of the things that we also need to be taking into account is the fact that you've got these different organizations, and some of them have more of an oversight role, and some of them have more of an operational control of the system. And so it's important to sort of separate that regulatory or some sort of oversight role from the actual operations of the system. And so that's part of what is we're trying to do in terms of how the system is organized. So some of these reliability standards, this is an organization that's separate from the utilities. The utilities are ultimately responsible for dispatching these resources and using the grid.
All right, thank you. I see no other questions. Please continue.
I'll just say this last point here is that finding analogous correlatives to Alaska is pretty hard because we are such a tiny grid compared to almost any other market in the U.S. or even globally in terms of a really modern electric system. And so one of the things that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power has been trying to do is really find where these best practices exist in other markets. The problems we're trying to solve here are not unique to Alaska, and in many ways we're decades behind what other markets have done. So it gives us an opportunity to really see what's worked in other places, what happened, what didn't work, and like kind of bring those to Alaska.
Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, thank you very much for this presentation. Just very, very quickly, I remember a number of 400,000 people is the population that our rail belt is equates to. Is that the right number?
Representative McKay, through the chair, I think it's a little bit over 500,000.
Oh, okay, 500,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're trying to kind of get an idea, I just the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma is 411,000. So you're trying to kind of think about it in those terms. A city of, you know, if you kind of just think about it as a city of a little over 500,000 people would be another way to think about it.
Thank you, Representative
McKinney. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that point. And then the big challenge when you're looking at comparing it to something that's like very condensed from a geographic standpoint is you don't have these long extension cords that create these additional challenges for how you manage and balance that system, because it is tricky to be operating with these like long extension cords. The population is much more spread out. Hawaii is a potential example of a place that that has some similarities to Alaska, but their transmission lines are not nearly as long as ours. So that becomes a little bit less of an optimal example. Iceland is probably the best example. The grid there is about the same length as the rail belt grid, and it serves about 370,000 residents, just to give an example, to make that as a point of comparison. So they're probably one of the best examples that we could use. Texas is the other single state grid that we have in the U.S. That's literally two orders of magnitude larger than Alaska is in terms of the amount of kilowatt hours that are sold on an annual basis. So that there's things to learn from that, from their system, but they're much, much larger, and the system is much more complex than what we have here.
So we're a city with about eight different sub-districts, which is about 700 miles long.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of the problem.
Yes.
Anyway, go ahead. Please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. So alluding back to this study that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power did that Representative Prox alluded to a minute ago, and there's a link to the full report here. But one of the things that we found, this is really looking at different scenarios for power in the year 2050 and how we can maintain a reliable grid. And one of the more interesting things that I felt came out of this report is that we're really expecting the location of generation sources to change and the amount of power flowing north and south and when that's taking place to change over time. So again, we all benefit from an interconnected system. Where generation exists now, where it's probably going to be in the future, is going to change over time. But this idea of being able to move power north-south freely is going to benefit users and the individual cooperatives, the members of those cooperatives, over time. So there's really three primary goals that might be proposed for the rail belt. One is about this this question around the movement of electricity and the direct charges that are tied to that when you're trying to move power back and forth through the system. I'm gonna talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Secondly, that idea of having an organization that can oversee, manage, and develop those backbone transmission assets for the benefit of the whole, I think, is something that is a best practice for most energy markets. So Iceland would, in particular, it's very analogous to Alaska, where you have a lot of individual municipally owned utilities that are interconnected through a backbone grid. And they moved toward this structure three decades ago, and they're very happy with that. And then this idea of planning. Planning is a really important part of all of this. And so really thinking about how we might want to design a planning process that's really for the future and not based on developing the grid of the past.
So I have a question before we go on the next slide. Pancaking, it's kind of become the buzzword here with this process. So can you give us a definition? Because everybody's going to have to know what that is when they see the bills that are coming along. And so they're going to probably have to be understanding what pancaking means. Because it definitely refers to a type of organization layer. And if you go over that for us, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. I appreciate that. And yes, I guess this is still a morning meeting, so we can talk a little bit about stacking pancakes on top of each other. But that may be a word that we want to move a little bit away from. I'm not sure. But I think it does give a little bit of this visual of this idea that you're taking these different costs for moving across the transmission system and you're stacking them together. So For example, if you wanted to develop a wind farm or a coal plant on the northern part of the grid, and somebody on the southern end, such as Homer Electric, wanted to participate in that project, it's not just going to be the cost of energy for that generation source, but it's going to be that cost of energy with all of the transactional additional costs for moving that power across the grid to whoever the end off-taker is going to be on the other side of the system. And so these are rates that have been approved by the RCA. These aren't made-up numbers, right? These represent real costs for operating the transmission system. That includes, you know, the operations and maintenance, any debt, depreciation that's associated with those assets. And so basically those are fixed costs, right? And what happens is that those fixed costs are pooled, and normally the ratepayers in that region would pay. So if Golden Valley has a cost for their transmission assets, normally their ratepayers would pay. But if they're able, if there's electrons flowing through their grid and using that asset, it makes sense that whoever is moving that power would compensate Golden Valley for the use of that asset. And so that's kind of the way the system is set up right now. But what winds up happening is she makes economic choices. Remember, the actual cost for this asset is fixed, right? We don't have more costs associated with this system, more significant costs associated with it for sending more electrons to the system, right? Especially if it's not at times where there's any kind of a traffic jam happening. That's actually where there is additional cost to users. But just moving one more electron through the system doesn't necessarily create a significant additional cost burden to the system as a whole. Just like on a highway would be putting one more car during a low traffic time isn't actually going to add significantly to the use of that system. And so the idea here with pancaking rates is that if you, for example, were, I'll use the example, in Fairbanks, if you're Golden Valley and you wanted to purchase power from Fire Island, okay, you're not just going to pay that cost of energy, that wholesale cost of energy that SERI might offer that particular wind project for, but you're going to add on the cost for moving it through these different systems, through Matanuska Electric Association, Chugach, and Alaska Energy. Actually, maybe not MEA in that particular case, but Chugach and AEA toll to get it up to Fairbanks. And so by the time you get it there, it might be cheaper for Fairbanks to do something locally, to spin up some local generation, whereas that's not necessarily the most economic choice for the system as a whole. It'd be nice if they could have that cheaper energy from that particular energy source. And it's also not necessarily going to be conducive to getting those new projects put onto the grid. And does this make sense? So that idea of like having these stacked pancakes really inhibits the development of projects at scale. It incentivizes the development of local energy projects only. And we want to build bigger projects that are more economical, whether they're renewables or whether they're fossil fuel or whatever those projects look like.
So are those numbers the numbers that we have actually going on today? Are they the ones that are futuristic? Are they just for this presentation? The numbers in the highway you draw on there on the right.
Thank you, Chair.
0.00512 per kilowatt in AEA toll.
Yeah. So thank you, Chair Rauscher. I do believe that these are the current rates that are being offered by the utilities. If you would like me to double check that, I can do so. I will acknowledge that I did pull these numbers from another presentation that was given in the Senate. And so so I have not double checked these numbers myself.
I was just wondering what they
but represent. They are basically representative of the costs that are being paid today. And again, we're not, these are real costs. These are fixed costs. So the way that you can manage not having these this economic disincentive to develop new projects on the grid is not, you're not going to get rid of these costs. They're real costs. We're really talking about how to reallocate these costs or how to really look at differently on how we're recouping these costs from the end users of the system. And again, this is looking really at best practices across other systems and what other energy markets have done around the world. We're not making up a new idea. This is sort of what a best practice is in most places.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
Yeah. So in this particular case, ASEP did take a close look at Texas. Texas has a really streamlined system for how they handle the recovery of costs associated with their transmission system. And one thing that they do that I do think is also important is not only do they decouple it from the movement of electrons through the system, so they decouple that cost from if you're going to put power on the grid, we're going to charge the person that's moving those electrons, so that power will be burdened with the cost for the movement of the energy through the system. But they also really take a look at when do we make decisions on how we reallocate the cost of power to the users in the system. And one of the things to consider is much like highways, you may be able to have a lot of cars on the highway, but if they're spread out through the day and night, it's not really going to cause additional cost burden for you can move a lot of cars. What happens is when there's a traffic jam, that's when it becomes a cost both to the users of the system, and that's also what's going to dictate the need to build out a new lane or a new highway or something like that, is really about when there's a traffic jam. And it's really the same thing when it comes to the movement of electricity. The issue is when you have a bottleneck in the system, when you're not able to move as much of that economic power back and forth through the system as you would ideally like to. That's when you want to look at upgrading your system. And so there's a desire to move away from tying the cost of using the transmission system away from being sort of this tied to energy moving through the system to just more of like, what is the proportion of your users, your utility users, are contributing to that peak traffic jam period of time. And this is the way Texas does it. They call this coincident peak demand. So the coincident when everybody is peaking at the same time, when they're most, the system is being used the heaviest, stop, you know, musical chairs, everyone stop. What proportion of the system are you using at that particular moment? And then we allocate that portion of the cost to the users of that particular utility, essentially. Texas is interesting because they are an isolated system, so they set a lot of their rules. They're exempt from a lot of these rules that relate to moving power across state lines, just like Alaska is. And so from that standpoint, they have a unique model that we can also adopt because we're in a similar position of them where we're not moving power across state lines. So again, you know, each utility is responsible for their own costs associated with their transmission assets that they own. But some of that cost burden ultimately can get shifted to members, users of other parts of the grid. When you're moving electrons through that system, you have a situation, and I kind of tried to give a small example here. I don't know that I'll go into this in detail right now, but you know, basically what you can do is as others are using your portion of the grid, you can shift the cost that your users would have otherwise paid onto consumers in other parts of the system. And that goes the other way around too. It works both ways. And so this is another factor in how currently transmission costs are being recouped from the different utilities.
Representative Prox has a question.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. Will the transmission costs be based on peak load and number of kilowatts transmitted, or just one or the other?
Thank you, Representative Prox, through the chair. You know, I think that it can be really complicated even for the folks that work in this industry to really differentiate between those, because when we're talking about load, that's really more of a question around power, right? It's the instantaneous demand of the system at any point in time. What's the load at this moment on the system versus like the annual amount of kilowatt hours sold is an energy measurement. Mm-hmm. So it's really about, are we looking at recouping these costs based on energy and energy value, or based on power, the maximum power, the biggest traffic, the use at any particular moment in the system. Mm-hmm. There are, right now, we're using energy as a metric. There is legislation that has been proposed that use both. And so they can be both applied as a metric. Typically speaking, what industry has converged on is this question around whether looking at that peak demand, so that's a power measurement, mm-hmm. Might be a better metric. But to be honest with you, I think this is something that the utilities can reasonably weigh in on and sort out, because at the end of the day, I'm not certain about the implications for looking at it from an energy standpoint versus demand for the grid for Alaska.
If I might follow up.
Is there a follow up?
Yep. The reason I asked, I worked at Pump Station 8 a couple of decades ago, and we had to have standby generators in case Golden Valley went offline. And Golden Valley, that was before they put the substation in out there. And when the drag line at Healy started up, it swung the power enough that it knocked us offline, so we had to keep using our standby generator. And then we kind of did the arithmetic and figured out that it was actually less expensive to just use the generator. And then after a year, the demand charge was supposed to go down, and then we really would have made some money off of it. And the same thing would happen if there's large industrial users, or if you talk about, or could happen, I guess, the Golden Valley system as a whole. There's some point where it pays to just generate your own. And is that being calculated into this upgrade charge, or is it just that we're getting the, with federal money, it doesn't work because we're paying for the electricity through inflation. But is that calculated in, or should it be calculated in?
Mm-hmm. Representative Prox, through the chair. So I think industrial users do have different criteria, mm-hmm. for how they access the grid. And you mentioned this demand charge, for example. I lived off the grid myself for 20 years. I wasn't connected to the rail belt grid. And it's difficult for me to state that it's cheaper, mm-hmm. to get power for self-generating it. That hasn't been my experience. It may be that in the case of the pump station, that they felt they had more reliable power.
Yep.
And that there was real value in that reliability of that power.
It was interesting. There was certainly value in the reliability.
Yeah.
But also it turned out that it was just bomb less expensive because we were connected right up to the fuel source. That was a special case. Get it. But that'll happen in different places. Like,
there,
the line, if they set up a generating system out there, maybe they would be better off generating their own power.
Users can choose to do what they want, and generating your own power behind the meter, mm-hmm. is certainly an option both for individual residents or for commercial businesses. Mm-hmm. That's something that is a individual economic decision, and no one is preventing or incentivizing that. That's a decision that an individual user would make. I believe what you're saying is that, are we going to get to a point where the costs are so high that it's going to incentivize users to remove themselves from the system? Uh-huh. There might be other reasons why commercial users might also choose to disconnect from the grid. One of them is that a lot of these large industrial users have set standards, targets for decarbonizing, uh-huh. their operations. And one of the challenges that I think that we have is, in taking a look at that from a business standpoint, is that if we are, as a grid, not able to meet some of those decarbonization standards for our industrial customers. I'll give an example. I know that Kinross Fort Knox has a 100% decarbonization target in the future. And their operations in Fairbanks are the most carbon intensive operations that they have globally. And that's a challenge for them. Mm-hmm. So that might be a reason for them to choose to look for a lower carbon source of energy that they could purchase directly or produce themselves. But these are individual business decisions to make that I think, again, we're trying to move toward more of a free market approach to this, where there's more local choice in what kind of power you're getting from who and when.
Okay, thank you.
All right, please continue.
I just want to mention that we did a pretty extensive study looking at the Icelandic energy market and the way that that has been designed. Part of the reason for that is that Iceland actually has very inexpensive power. Their rates for most residential users is around 11 cents a kilowatt hour, which is quite a lot cheaper, probably more than less than half the cost of most rail belt users today. And their industrial rates are about 7 cents a kilowatt hour. And what they've seen there is there's a lot of influx of businesses that want to set up shop in Iceland that are interested in locating in Iceland because of the cheap cost of power, and also to a secondary extent, the fact that most of their power is from non-carbon sources of energy. 30 years ago, they were forced by EU regulations to deregulate their market, their energy market. And part of what they did with that is create a separate transmission organization, a company that sort of pooled the assets from the different individual utilities and those that were owned by the state, and formed this organization called Landsnet. At the time, there was a little bit of kicking and screaming, especially from some of the utilities about forming that organization. But I haven't found anybody in Iceland, and I've spent a lot of time in Iceland as both a Fulbright scholar and just as somebody that teaches some courses over there from time to time. They pretty much universally agree that this was a really important step for them in terms of opening up their energy market to competition, and has allowed them to keep costs low. So in that case, they have all kinds of different generators, both independent generators, utility-owned generators, and state-owned generation sources that all feed into this market. And then you've got distribution utilities and ultimately the retail market that can basically have a lot of say over where they're getting their power from and ultimately how much they're willing to pay for that power. So it's a really successful model, I think. It's also pretty simple because they're just not very big. So they keep these organizations pretty lean and pretty structured in terms of their roles and responsibilities. And so I do think that this is something that Alaska could benefit from, because their market is probably the most analogous to ours, at least that we've been able to find anywhere in the world. So this is an example of something that we could use to kind of Alaskanize the model that Iceland has successfully adopted and evolved over 3 decades. The Bradley Lake Project is an example of where there is a structure in place to manage an asset, in this case, the state-owned Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. This could potentially be adapted, not wholesale, with some changes, to a similar kind of organization that could manage transmission assets. And part of the reason why I think it would be interesting to do this now is because right now the state of Alaska owns about a third of the transmission assets for the rail belt grid. And as we have these additional new projects that are being contemplated through the GRIP funding, that would start to approach about 50% of the assets on the rail belt grid. And so that idea of saying we're not just going to lump everything together with Bradley Lake in terms of state-owned assets, but really say we're going to create a separate transmission organization that is streamlined and simple, much like this. This is not an expensive organization. This is a relatively simple model. It could be kind of blended with what they're doing in Iceland as an approach that's inexpensive and effective, especially as we're looking toward new transmission assets mostly being owned by the state. And then I just wanted to mention again with this planning process, you know, one thing that Hawaii has done, they have some also very aggressive targets to 100% decarbonization. And one of the things they've gone to is a more holistic approach to energy planning that includes not just transmission, but also generation and distribution. And so they consider this kind of a more whole system approach called integrated grid planning. And so this is something else to kind of think about instead of breaking these all apart and saying we're going to do planning around future generation assets that's separate from transmission assets, that's separate from the needs of our distribution system, you know, how you're actually getting the power to individual homes and users of the system, putting that all together and thinking a little bit more holistic about it and doing a planning approach that's really more geared to the future rather than a planning process that's grounded in sort of the way things have been done historically. So again, I just list these three ideas for goals that that I think would move us forward in terms of modernizing our energy system. In addition, and this is more on the institutional side and the organizational side, that complements the upgrades that we want to be doing to the actual physical assets of that transmission system. So that economic and then that institutional reform that sort of mirrors our current plan to upgrade the physical transmission assets. So I'll end with that.
We got a couple questions.
Representative McKay has a couple questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Chairman Rauscher. Through the chair, Ms. Holman, thank you very much for the presentation. And I just want to maybe talk about a couple things while you're here. Considered an expert on energy in Alaska. So, as you know, we're supposed to start seeing the gap in Cook Inlet gas starting in 27, give or take, 2027. I'm told that the earliest we could get LNG import capability is 2030. So it's right now it's 2024. So that gives us kind of 6 years to work on. And, you know, we're not going to build any dams that fast. I think even the Dixon diversion is going to take a number of years. We're not going to build a nuclear power plant. We're not going to be able to build a coal power. Nothing's going to be built that fast to handle that six-year period. So, in my opinion, we're still looking at having to do something with Cook Inlet gas in that short term, this next 6 years. So, a couple things. If you go back to slide two, I guess it is. When you look at the rail belt energy delivery grid that we have now, even with its shortcomings, we're talking about a grid that delivers power from Seldovia all the way to Delta Junction. And you tell me if I'm wrong or inaccurate.
Yeah.
So whatever we do, it's here. Yeah. This is our current grid. Even though it has shortcomings, but what we do with Cook Inlet gas affects that entire grid. Because I think there's a paradigm, and I'll pick on my folks that live in Fairbanks and North Pole, that they'll say, "Oh, what you do with Cook Inlet gas has nothing to do with Fairbanks." And I'm like, not so sure about that. I think whether we like it or not. And I'm, like I said, I'm just picking on my colleagues up north. But whatever we do with Cook Inlet gas affects that whole grid, more or less.
Absolutely.
From Seldovia all the way to Delta Junction. The grid upgrades that you're recommending, they're going to take several years to put in place as well. So I guess I'm kind of dealing with the here and now. Mm-hmm. And I want to dispel the paradigm that we're all connected to this problem except Southeast Alaska, because they rely primarily on hydro, if I'm not mistaken. or their local generation. Also, what we do in Cook Inlet regarding gas and the cost of energy affects the PCE indirectly, right? Because the PCE subsidy is linked to the cost of energy in the rail belt. So our 500,000 people plus the bush that's impacted by PCE is we're all in this boat together with Cook Inlet Gas. So I guess, is that a true statement of assumptions?
Yeah, Representative McKay, through the chair, you've made some really astute points. One of the things that we've seen is that historically we've actually had a smaller payout annually for the PCE program. This has changed now with we've increased the number of eligible kilowatt hour sales from like 500 to 750. But prior to that, we saw an annual decrease in the payout in the PCE program, and that's directly tied to the increase of energy costs on the rail belt. So you make a really astute analogy there. That formula is based on the average cost between Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. And
right.
So as we're seeing these increased costs on the rail belt grid, it absolutely impacts rural Alaska as well.
Okay, and then one quick follow-up, if I might, Representative Rauscher.
Certainly.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Holden, one thing I forgot to mention is the military bases. There's a bigger picture at play here. Our military bases must have reliable power all the time and for national security purposes. So to me, that gives us an added level of urgency that we need to really look at this whole system very, very carefully so that we don't jeopardize our bases. I'm thinking about J-Bear and Eielson and their ability to function 24/7. And so thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those are what I want to kind of clear up.
You betcha.
You betcha.
Any other questions for Sue? So I got a question. How does the transmission upgrade help to balance the initial costs of the infrastructure upgrades against the expected economic benefits?
Representative Rauscher, I think that's a really excellent question, right? So we're basically saying that by making these upgrades, which will cost somebody some money, right? There is a cost associated with that. We're making the assumption that there's going to be a higher value associated with the construction of those assets. And I think that the utilities have worked really hard to kind of quantify what that potential benefit is for the upgrade of those assets, which they included in their Department of Energy proposal. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I can say that it's a significant benefit, especially when you look at the longevity of these kinds of assets. Transmission assets are expected to last a very long time. And so potential benefit, even with deconstraining our existing assets like the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, is quite significant. Adding in elements like energy storage to the mix allows us to really firm up and add reliability to the system, which is an asset or a technology that wasn't really available many years ago. And there are these projects that are under construction now, right? Right now we're building out new energy storage opportunities. There are things, I share Representative McKay's concern about this sort of interim solution. I would also like to mention that while gas is very important for power generation, about twice as much gas is being used for heating our homes in Anchorage. And so that's actually almost a bigger concern of how do we address that? Because we can more easily switch over to other forms of electric power generation than we can switch over to alternative forms of heating. So this all fits together. And this is part of why a larger strategy related to energy for the rail belt grid is really important. I really appreciate what the governor did in forming a task force that included a subcommittee that really took a strong look at the rail belt grid and made several recommendations that are actually consistent with the presentation I gave you all today here, because these are important questions for our future, and we need to look at both the short term, the midterm, and the long term solutions here. So,
Representative McKay, I see you wanting to say something.
Well, I'm really glad to have a conversation, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, the other point I'd like to make is some folks say, "Well, let the market decide. Let's import LNG and." You know, just let things, don't do anything. Just let the market, free market decide. And I would love to do that. But we're not connected to the free market yet. We're not theoretically connected to the free market at all until 2030, when we can, when the predictions are we could accept imported LNG. So we might as well be on Mars. Because we can't even if I was king of Alaska today and I said bring in a load of LNG tomorrow, we wouldn't be able to unload it. So you know, at least for 6 years here, this is all hypothetical. So again, I come back to, in the next 6 years, we've got to have solutions that are realistic and take care of, I don't know, 600,000 people, 700,000 people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you betcha. Representative McKay, thank you. So I Representative Prox has a question.
First question is, how are we doing on time?
We're okay.
Okay. So thinking in the long term, I actually don't disagree with Representative McKay in the short term, but thinking in the long term, how much, and thinking about Fairbanks, how much of the load, we'll call it in the interior, is this new upgraded intertie capable of handling? The whole works, or what percentage?
Representative Prox, through the chair. Right now, these first couple of upgrades don't actually address the northern part mm-hmm. of the system.
Right.
And so the impacts to Fairbanks are somewhat indirect. For example, unconstraining Bradley Lake benefits Golden Valley because they own 10%, or they receive 10% of the power from that system, roughly. And so, so right now for Fairbanks, again, we benefit from being part of an interconnected system. The cheapest power that Fairbanks has available to it is what's coming up that intertie, right? That's the cheapest power today.
Right. Is the current intertie, is that the limit of the power that Golden Valley can purchase? Is it limited by the capacity of the intertie right now?
Yeah, Representative Prox, yes, it is limited.
Okay.
Yeah.
And give or take, is it about 20% of the total power consumed in the interior?
Representative Prox, it's higher than 20%. I can't tell you exactly what that number is, but it's significantly higher than 20%.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then eventually phase two or phase three, something like that,
yes.
Which would be 15, 20 years in the future, I'm thinking. That's when the final upgrade would benefit the interior. Is that a fair statement?
I would like to think that it won't take 15 to 20 years, but it would certainly be probably more than five, right? And so that's why in the northern part of the system, there's other things being looked at. For example, this long-duration energy storage system, which I think could benefit the system as a whole. Again, we can make upgrades on both sides of the system that provide value. And so that idea of how can we use the system as we have it today while we're designing the system for the future? There's also opportunities for building new generation in Fairbanks that could result in more power flowing south.
Right.
And that is that's an interesting part of this equation to consider as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I was going. So if it is 10 years rather than 15, that makes a difference?
Director Thayer was here and said it'd be 2030 to 2032.
2030 to 2032 to complete the project. So call it 32. We're looking at 8 years. I mean, that's important in making other decisions of Golden Valley expanding their generating capacity.
And I believe that that 8 years is more related to the existing GRIP projects that have been funded. The northern projects have not yet been funded. So that would be like a GRIP phase two would be the hope. So.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Give me one more. What is the relative certainty of... I'm sorry, yes, through the chair. What is the relative certainty of phase two or phase three, the future phases? That's federal funding coming our way.
Yeah.
Is that...
Potentially. Representative Prox through the chair. Those upgrades probably need to be made whether there's federal investment in them or not, right? And so so that's something to be considering. Like, we are baselining, like, can we get some federal investment in these systems? But long term, those upgrades are needed to strengthen the system as a whole. The question is just who pays for them,
right,
to some extent.
Right.
And in terms of like the certainty of that, one thing when we look at these sorts of federal grant opportunities, it's also important for them to feel that that the state or the utilities are going to have a plan for paying their 50%, their component of that. And so that's one thing that that I'd like to see as a strategy for making sure that the match has been identified for GRIP so that we put ourselves in a better position to get funding for future iterations of that as well.
Yep. Thank you.
You betcha. Any other questions for Ms. Holman? Well, Ms. Holman, we appreciate you coming here and giving us your intellect, your presentation. We thank you for your answers. We thank you for your time that you've spent here in the committee. Appreciate the work that you do at the university, the work that you've always done on microprocessors. And I've always appreciated that. And so the committee has nothing else that we have before us. So I'm going to adjourn this meeting. Our next meeting is on Thursday at 10:15. We'll hear a presentation from
John Sims.
NSTAR. All right, John Sims. Meeting is adjourned at 11:30.